if you don't face into the reality of where you're at today, you're not going to pay homage to the past. So you're not going to bring the good stuff over, but nor are you going to delete the bad stuff. You're just going to repeat the average things constantly. And that tends to this like midpoint of uselessness. So I'm like, let's not do that. So let's face the reality, honest reality of where we're at today. What are the things we need to kind of unlearn and maybe reduce or get rid of? And what are the things we need to elevate?
Welcome to the Unlearn Podcast, where host Barry O'Reilly seeks to synthesize the superpowers of extraordinary individuals to think big, start small, and learn fast. Here's your host, Barry O'Reilly.
Welcome to the Unlearn Podcast. On this show, I'm delighted to be joined by Dom Price, work futurist at Atlassian. Now, I've had the pleasure of knowing Dom for a number of years. He actually was at the book launch for Unlearn in Sydney, where we connected for the first time in person and instantly had a great rapport. He's been focused on the future of work, unleashing the power of teams, and helping companies get better. At Atlassian, they build a culture of innovation, inclusivity, and exciting ideas around team rituals and playbooks, many of which Dom has helped author and is working on currently that you'll hear on this show. But his background is kind of interesting and diverse. He didn't start off in the future work. He actually started as an accountant working in Deloitte in London. And yet, how he's developed himself, put himself outside his comfort zone, found new ways and interest areas, learned, unlearned, is a fascinating journey that we'll dive into on this show. But before we get started, let's hear about some of those key turning points that happened for Dom in the earliest stages of his career.
Me and my girlfriend, we're getting married later this year, right? And we were talking about sliding doors moments in our lives. And one of mine was a career one, right? And at the time, honestly, completely insignificant. I spent 3 years at Deloitte in London. I did okay. I didn't particularly love it. I don't think I was thriving there, but I didn't know what thriving actually meant in the workplace. That concept, as a Northern English guy, the idea of thriving in the workplace was a very distant thing that I wasn't worried about at the age of 20-something, right? I was telling my in-laws and some friends the other day, I was like, growing up as a kid in Manchester, you weren't expected to like your job or your career. That wasn't part of the tapestry of life, right? The idea was is you went to the pub on a Friday and you needed a lot of material to whinge about how bad your week was. And so for me, I was like, yeah, I'm in London. I'm working at Deloitte. Seems like a cool thing. Don't particularly love it. Don't hate it. I'll just do this for like 45, 50 years and my life will be fine. And I was just kind of plodding along. And a weird thing happened in Deloitte back in the day. I stood as a chartered accountant. Who knows why? We can cover that separately. But when you had been trained as a chartered accountant, Deloitte did a wonderful thing of paying you nothing, like peanuts, literally peanuts. And then the minute you qualified, they realized that you were great fodder in the market. And they'd like double your salary. I'm like, wow, I didn't get any more valuable today. But just because I passed a really boring accountancy exam, suddenly I'm worth more. And I started to just, you know, put the feelers out, and get a feel for what was out there. And my boss at the time, a chap called Ravi Joshi, never thought much of Ravi at the time. And the guy's an absolute legend in my mind now. Took me out for sushi. It's the most expensive sushi he's ever bought in his life. I'd never been to Sushi Train, Northern English guy. I didn't realize you're paid by the plate, right? For those that don't know, I'm 6'4", 115 kilos, and I can put away sushi. So
I've seen you.
You've seen me eat and you've seen me drink. So he's just watching me scoff this food. And we're chatting away and he's like, Dom, I'm worried that you might be looking for another job. And I was like, actually, I am. And he's like, look, I don't think now is a great time for you to leave Deloitte. Have you thought about doing the same job somewhere else? And I was like, no, like, of course I haven't. I'm not thinking that far ahead. That's not in my schema. And he's like, would you be interested? And we had a bit of chat about it. I was like, yeah, maybe. So that was the Friday. He came into work on the Monday. He said, I've made some calls, New York or Sydney. And I was like, I don't know you well enough to go on holiday with you, mate. And he's like, no, like your job exists in Deloitte, New York or Deloitte, Sydney. And I was like, so all my friends said New York. Every single one of my friends said go to New York. Because it's bigger and it's better and it's bolder and it's all these things. And I'm like, it feels too much like London. Whereas Sydney was like the opposite. So the department I was in London was like 450 people. The same department in Sydney was 25. And there was something nice about that because I had to do the full stack. I had to do everything. So it was a great experience. And then I didn't realize probably for a good few years after that, what a favor he'd done me in my career to go, mate, you're about to go down one fork in the road of going, joining some random bank and being an internal auditor, you'll get good money, you'll wear a suit, and you'll hate yourself for life. Or I can put you on a plane to Sydney. You don't know anyone, you're going by yourself, but I'm going to back you to do that. And that moment, I look back now, that was pivotal.
Yeah, that's fascinating to hear you share that. But one thing that really jumps out at me that you sort of mentioned is this notion of going to Sydney because it's not New York and it's not like London, but also this idea of there's 25 people there. You know, you're going to get to do a much broader range of things and stretch yourself in a different type of way. That resonates massively with me because I never did well in big companies. You know, once I always felt like once companies started hitting like even a couple of thousand, I felt like the ability to tie both what I was doing with impact or like I just like to sort of be able to see how what I'm doing connects to things. And in a smaller company team group and watching that grow, I enjoyed that because I liked sort of, you know, fixing the light bulbs and then, you know, changing the waterworks or whatever that needs to be done.
I'd imagine you hate being put in a box.
Oh, look, it's always one of these things that's very hard for me where I like getting my hands dirty. I like sort of trying different things.
Well, you don't fit in a category. And I think when you're in a small company, not fitting in a category is a plus. It's like, yeah, you mix around. And then you get to a certain size and like, I need a specialist in this one thing. And you're like, oh, no, I do five things like really well. And like, no, I want you to do one thing. And you're like, that's not me.
It's always sort of fun and games, I think. Because I saw this in different companies I was in over time, right? Whether they were startups or especially ThoughtWorks started to become a bigger company. And, you know, like it's always been fascinating for me. So tell us a little bit more about like what were like some of the first steps. Like you went to Sydney, had a great time. You still live there today now. But you also got these opportunities to sort of look at different skills, different roles. You eventually joined Atlassian in the sort of early days of the company too as well. So, you know, what were some of those steps to figure out, like finding your jam, if you will? Like what was the things that helped you sort of go through that process?
I wish it was as like simple and logical as like showing someone a process flow, right? So someone else could follow. But probably similar to you, Barry, is because I never fitted into a singular box and nor did that give me any sense of reward or satisfaction, I always saw multiple boxes. And therefore, whenever I saw a new box, I'm like, ooh, new box. Like everyone else is sat there going, it might go wrong. What if it's not a real box? And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to dive in. It's a box. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? And so my entire career, if you map it out, is very opportunistic. And you can try and reverse engineer it and tease out some kind of red thread and go, oh, here's why. And I'm like, it's not that sophisticated. It's literally opportunistic. So, you know, when I came to Sydney, smaller organization, the opportunity was, like I say, full stack, right? So the last job I did with Deloitte in London, I was one of 120 people at the client site. The first job I did in Sydney, I was the one person. And I'm like, oh, I'm collecting the information, doing the interviews, doing the documentation, writing it up, submitting it, and reviewing it. I got to do everything. Now, the thing was, it's entirely customized. So there was no blue chip recognition, right? My final client in Deloitte was this major international bank. So on paper, it looked great, no satisfaction for me. So I've just flipped that and gone, this doesn't look great, but great satisfaction for me. Sod it. I'm going to do more of that. That's a gravy train I can get on. So just started doing random engagements with random clients and really enjoyed it until I realized that the world of consulting wasn't for me, right? I liked the idea of advising, but I really wanted to get my hands dirty. I just wanted to do it. And so I took a bit of time out and went traveling the world. And when I came back, there was only one option. I had to go and join one of my clients, right, from my time at Deloitte, because I had to see it through. So I remember the day, the guy is still a friend of mine, Dave Hughes, hired me in an organization I'd done some consulting with for a few years. And on the first day, plonked these giant reports on my desk. And he's like, you wrote these, and now you can deliver on them. And I remember flicking through these highly utopian, generic recommendations from some absolute dipshit called Don Price, reading them going, wow, that's never going to work. That's not real. No one could achieve that in that time. And I'm reading them. I'm like, I own these now. So I got what I wished for. And I say, people, be careful what you wish for. But that sent me on this journey of going, I actually want to see it through because I want to know what reality is. I don't want to be a consultant forever in this utopian world of writing reports that it doesn't matter whether they're true or not. I actually want to see what happens at the coalface. So I did 3 and a bit years in an organization where I didn't love the product that the organization delivered, but I loved the fact that I got a huge amount of freedom and latitude. I had some senior leaders that were smart, that needed to turn things around. The company was in a mess, and I'm like, let's do that. But again, this random rich tapestry that took me from being a chartered accountant in Deloitte in 2000 to running software teams and development centers and large programs of work in 2030. And you're like, what? So in 13 years, there was this weird. There's no one day where it has kind of popped out as a butterfly from the chrysalis, but each day it was taking on random new opportunities. And every time a project came up, I'm the idiot that goes, yeah, I'll do that. I don't want to work out if I can do it or not. I've not got time for that. I work that out once we get started. So my bias for action helped, but it's also just surrounding yourself by people and going, I'll give it a go. And if you're going to support me, you want me to succeed. And I'll learn a huge amount along the way. It's why when I met you a few years ago, this concept of unlearning became really relevant, because I met the topic and you at a time when all that rich tapestry also meant a lot of baggage. When you change careers and you change modals and you change industries, you take baggage each time. And I don't think I'd really conceived how much baggage I was carrying. I remember conversing with you about it one day and I'm like, that's a lot of weight I'm carrying that's probably not adding a dividend right now.
Yeah, it's fascinating again to hear you just sort of share this stuff, right? Like so many people struggle where they're in jobs they don't like, where they see opportunities they'd love to give a go, but fear gets in the way, or there's some inhibition that's sort of limiting belief that they wouldn't be able to do it, they'd fail. Like a lot of these things, you know, and it's always refreshing to hear people share a little bit about giving things a shot. As you say, with this support around you, where you have a team that say they want you to succeed, they'll support you. They recognize that you're doing something new, right? Like that's a huge help for folks if they go into that.
Just on that though, also, you've got to work out what happens if it does go wrong. So I didn't blindly rush into these things. I'm like, I'm going to go and do this gig. What happens if it goes wrong? I'll go back to Deloitte. And then after that random gig, I'll go to Atlassian. If Atlassian doesn't go right, I can almost always go back. But the opportunity to step forward isn't open. That door's not open regularly. So when it opens, even a little sneak, I'm through it. Because I know if by any chance it goes wrong, I'll take that step back. And I think that's the simple math people can do. Often the cost of stepping forward is significantly less, right? So just give it a go.
That's a great analogy. No, I love it. It's all where all the growth is often as well. You're talking then again about this idea. And it was a pleasure to meet you. I think the first time we met in person was probably the launch of Unlearn down in Sydney, which was super. And at that stage, as you said, you were in Atlassian, a company like going through crazy growth, very fascinating culture, always open to sort of sharing new ways of working and so forth, right? And as you said, you started identifying somebody's whatever baggage you might have them, limiting beliefs, behaviors that you needed to work on. So what were some of the ones that sort of stood out to you as you were going into this very technology-driven type of culture in Atlassian, right? So you've done I can only imagine the vision of you in a suit and tie. Man, I don't think I've ever seen you wear a tie in my life.
Which is not pretty, yeah. Honestly. I look properly stupid.
Great. Okay, well, now we know. But you're in this, as you say, forward-thinking, progressive type of a culture, technology-driven in Atlassian, right? So what were some of the things that sort of struck you that you had to unlearn as you took your first steps in that environment?
The first one was in the first 90 days, and I didn't have the vocabulary of unlearn then, right? I didn't have your concepts in my head. So it was just me starting a job, and in the first 90 days, genuinely hating it. I hated my job. I hated Atlassian, and I really hated the people. They were evil. They were condescending introverts that talked about things I didn't understand. The closest I got to connecting with someone was over Monty Python. It was just a really daunting place. And the odd part was, it was like this twisted world. I thought, I didn't know what gaslighting was then, but I thought of being gaslit, because in my first few weeks, we came second in best place to work, right? And I'm like, how? How did you do it? You're all horrible people. I hate you all. Anyway, I did a bit of soul searching, chatting with my boss. He's like, how's it going? I was like, not enjoying it. And he's like, yeah, you've not hit the road. And I'm like, wow, okay, I've never had that feedback. I thought it was you. Apparently it's me. We had the chat and he's like, no. He's like, I hired you because you've got 13 years experience of seeing things go wrong and firefighting. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, you keep on starting fires. Stop starting fires. And I'm like, holy shit. Because I had nothing to do. I'd start a fire, put it out and go, see? And I was like, that's weird. Every time you're around, Dom, there's a fire. And I'm like, nah, it wasn't me. I just happened to be there. And he's like, no, we've hired you to fireproof. So he said, I want you to take what you've learned in the last 13 years, what you've seen happen and go wrong, reverse engineer it and prevent it from going wrong here as we scale. I'm like, oh, that's a brilliant job. And he walked out the room. Now, I'm over the moon because that's a dream job. I haven't got a Scooby how to do that. I'm like, thank you. That is an amazing job. How am I meant to do that? And he's like, explore, experiment, blah, blah, blah. And like, he rattled off all these words and he was too busy and too much of a genius that disappeared out the room. So he gave me the space and the time and freedom to say, think ahead, not back. And as we think ahead, so the example he gave was like, Dom, last year we hired 30 engineers and we're over the moon. We nailed it. Next year, we're going to hire 100. The way we hired 30, we can't do it three times over to hire 100. Not only how we hire them, but the candidate experience and the onboarding experience, how we integrate them and get them to, so I was like, oh, okay. And then he's like, and then how do we get them into teams? And how do those teams rise? So each time we went on a scaling journey, I got the opportunity to think about what our organization might look like and what new systems, new rituals, new habits would need. And I think there was a size where we naturally, when we added a new one, naturally removed the old one. And then at some magical point, we stopped removing and we just started adding until I felt this bloat, right? This organizational bloat of, oh, it just feels a bit heavy and a bit slow to get stuff done.
It's great to have these like little signals as you're describing, you know, like it's funny as well, your story, like your sort of entry into Atlassian. I always remember my time in ThoughtWorks when I joined on the first day, even the office was a very unique culture. You'd walk in, there were four, I don't know, like banquet style tables. And that was it. And I didn't know who anyone was. There was no offices. There was just like an open plan. And at the time, I didn't know, like we had our CEO sit on a right beside the person who like was just first day out of university. And you could not tell who anybody was or what they were doing. And there was no managers. I remember asking people like, do I have a manager? And they're like, yeah, you got to manage yourself. I'm like, how do I tell people I'm going on holidays? They're like,
that's it. But also you're like in the interview, you said you were driven and you're like, no, I am. I'm driven with a manager, like someone who drives me.
It was one of these things where at the time I was totally discombobulated by these concepts about how do I operate in this world? And believe me, like it took me a while to sort of figure out not only the company code, but what worked for me and how I could find my place, the company.
Finding your role, because there's this temptation to just mimic and then you're like, they've not hired me to mimic. They've hired me to be me, but a new version of me. And that's that discomfort of going, if I bring my old artillery, that's going to fail. If I just mimic them, that's a waste of time. We just added a headcount, not a new cognitive load. So how do I think differently, but not suffer organ rejection?
It was really tough, you know? And just like you're describing, like, I feel like my first 6 months, you know, I'd come home and I'd be like, what happened today? Did I help somebody? Did I get better? Did I just make a mistake? And it was definitely, you know, a period that was, interestingly, a lot of growth, a lot of uncomfortableness. But then I started to find, as you say, the things that I could help or were natural to me. And they'd be simple things like, at the time, ThoughtWorks was a massive engineering culture. Literally, if you weren't an engineer, people would be like, sorry, what do you do?
Oh, that you're was, not that an engineer? My first week.
What do you do?
I'm a program manager. And they're like, no, it doesn't compute.
You would know to a one. Like,
I'm like, I like the gray area between black and white. But like,
oh, it was so funny. You know, I think we had like one UX person in the whole company. And then it was, I still remember trying to get designers into the company. That was a fun experience in itself.
How did you change it? Because I was really fortunate that I had some really caring people. They were blunt, but caring, the right amount of fact and tact that gave me feedback. Because without that feedback, I don't know that I would have self-navigated through that without the right nudges and arms around the shoulder.
Yeah, no, it was a very interesting dynamic, right? Like it was definitely high expectation. You knew people were good at what they did and they looked for excellence in what you were going to bring to the team.
Yeah, everyone's there to lift the bar.
Literally, you know, like hilariously, like I think one of the first people I met on my first day was a guy called Jim Weber, and he's sort of renowned for, at the time, he was writing all these ideas around service-oriented architecture or APIs. He'd written 3 or 4 books. And he's like, hi, I'm Jim Weber. Looking forward to you trying to manage me on a project. And I was like, oh, this is going to be hilarious.
Challenge accepted.
Very dry humor, but, you know, just a fantastic guy, you know. But instantly I was like, you know, you have all these anxieties about, am I good enough? These people are like, I'm playing in the Premier League now. It was a good sense, but that was it. Like finding the thing that was unique to me or my point of difference to the team, that was actually where things started to really light up for me, because I was working with a lot of engineers that were super bright. They could decompose problems. They could build awesome architecture, scalable, whatever. But one of the things that was lacking in that company at the time was there was not a lot of people who knew how to build products, who were comfortable talking to customers, prototyping, testing. because my previous world had been in startups and small teams, you know, I was used to like drawing mock-ups and going, showing them to customers or running user tests. And I started doing this on some of the projects with engineers and they were like, this is amazing. I thought that
the thing you saw as just normal, they're seeing it and going, wow, that's I'd pay for that.
It was fascinating, you know. It sort of then kickstarted this, like, yeah, just a different type of collaboration then that would happen where the engineers were suddenly like, all right, yeah, let's go talk to customers. Yeah, let's get feedback on what we're building. Does anyone care? Like, it doesn't matter how well it's, well, it matters it's well engineered, but no one uses it.
Does anyone actually want it?
Yeah, that was sort of a huge breakthrough for me. And then I could start to understand more about myself. It gave me a bit of confidence. And, you know, the massive accelerator was someone encouraged me to say, you should start writing about this.
Yeah, share it more broadly.
Yeah, and I'm dyslexic. So writing for me was like scaling a vertical wall. But again, the thing that started to happen is that people started to encourage me more and go, look, write a draft. I'll give you feedback on it.
So, yeah. We'll amplify. So it's funny. So my experience was not that subtle. Mine was way more brutal, which was, I don't think I ever had honest feedback in 13 years. We'd played the feedback game with the feedback sandwich and all the dance and the theater and whatever else. I'd never had actual feedback. So after 13 years of thinking I had and I hadn't, when I finally got it, really confronting. I'm like, whoa, like, tell me what you really think. And people are like, I just did. I'm like, no, I know. And it really fucking offended me. And then I'm like, they're not having a go. It took me ages to realize they're not trying to punish me or put me down. They're trying to just chisel the sharp edges and help me. And so each time I got that, I'm like, just pause, just like absorb it and consume it and then work it out. And eventually I found a niche like you, but it was through some quite sharp elbows along the way. But similar experience, I'm like, you're highly intelligent people. You're not threatened by me. So you're not doing this in some kind of weird political game. So I genuinely believe you're doing it for my best interest. You just need to understand I've not had feedback for 13 years and I thought I was really good. And so when you think you're amazing and your proverbial doesn't stink and you get your first bit of feedback 13 years into your career, you're like, oh, that, yeah, okay. I probably needed that a while ago.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. You're reminding me of so many stories now. Like one of the great things we did, we didn't have manners in ThoughtWorks at the time, but we had this notion of like a sponsor, someone who would, when it was, you were totally discombobulated, you could press the red button and this person was obliged to answer the phone and go, okay,
yeah.
How you doing there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And mine, I was very lucky. I had this guy, Andy Kane. He's since gone on to do amazing things. Like he worked a lot with the government digital services in the UK when they did a lot of work there. He was one of the best people for me. Because I remember that first time, as you said, I got all this first round of feedback and it did feel like an ocean weight, like sort of pouring over me of, again, well-intended, pointed. It was like a lot, you know, and he was great. They sat down, he went through it all with me and he's like, look, there's 10, 15 things here, but there's probably two or three that you need to like focus on and work on them and then get to the others. And it just helped me like let a breath out and go, okay, this isn't just all, you know, you don't tie your shoelaces right, you know, you don't do, you know, whatever.
It's not as big and dramatic as we think. It's funny, I was saying to her, I was trying to say, similar to you, I have this goal at the minute where I'm like, I need people from random backgrounds to spar with because people from the same background I just find boring. I'm done with confirmation bias. So my Sunday morning was spent with the director of basketball operations from San Antonio Spurs basketball team. Why? Because I think there's no overlap between my world and his, right? Apart from the fact that he's 6'7 and I'm 6'4, I'm like two giants walking around Sydney. But I'm like, tell me about how you think about it in your world, how you recruit, how you think about culture, how you think about team. There's the team on the pitch, right? Do playing basketball. There's the team off, right? Off the court. There's what happens front office, back up. And he explained it all. And I'm taking huge amounts of notes and I'm learning from that because it's different. But it takes a certain, I don't know, a certain age or confidence or experience when you're like, I'm comfortable not seeking confirmation anymore because I know what I know. It's what I don't know that's valuable. And how do I go and seek that to challenge myself on purpose and feel that discomfort? I'm just glad I'm in a position now where that is something I look forward to and enjoy, where it used to be probably something I avoided.
It's another great point, right? Like seeking out both those types of people and those types of spaces is certainly something I think people, you know, I certainly had to learn it too as well over time. One of the blogs I wrote this year was about proximity and plateaus. The notion for me, I have found, and this would be actually fascinating to get your thoughts on this. So with remote work, like we can work from anywhere, often you're not in person with people. And one of the things I found that's really important for me is actually getting together with groups of people to talk about like getting better at things that I actually am not good at. So as you're describing, like you found, you know, this person who you can take a walk around Sydney with, who's got excellence in their field that you can learn from. So for me, this notion of trying to put myself in these groups, whether they're masterminds or people of similar interest who are like trying to get better at things that I'm curious to learn, has been massive for me to avoid this notion of like plateaus, of like learning something and then naturally you hit a local maximum.
Barry, one of my biggest fears for 2024 is mediocrity. In the distributed world, it's easy because you're like, I'll do my task and I'll do my thing and I'll nip to the supermarket and I'll make my dinner. And I'm like, I'm a 46-year-old man who's going through a midlife crisis. I'm not ready to put my comfy slippers on. I've got the hunger, but if I don't seek that stuff out, the hunger goes. And actually, I'm like, oh, I'm content. This is fine. And I don't want fine. I don't want okay. I don't want nice. But there's two avenues that I literally have to like kick myself to do this. One is the orthogonal one, like you, the masters of a different field. And then last week, I flew my team in from around the world and we hung out in Sydney for the week. But the very first thing we did on Monday morning when they landed, we did the Bondi to Coogee walk and back again. 14-kilometer walk. Just as three humans, just shoes, socks, shorts, t-shirt, like just walk and talk side by side, not boss, leader, subordinate, right? No one-on-one. It's just, let's just walk and talk and hang out. And then we did a walk on Tuesday because the walk on Monday went so well because we missed that connection. Now, we bump into each other at events and hang out throughout the year, but that was a week of intentional togetherness and we all rose in that week. We raised the ceiling, we raised the floor. Everyone benefited from that week. We can't be in person all year round because we live in different continents. But that week for me, there's a level of connection and bonding and discussion and trust, whatever the magical words are, it just made sense. But I find when I don't have that consistent time frame, I just wallow in mediocrity and then everything's fine. It's like, yes, okay.
It's definitely become top of mind for me too, trying to create those opportunities. Listening to your story, right? Like your journey's fascinating, things you have to unlearn. What are some of the things you think about even in our industry now? Like what are some of the themes that you're seeing that like as an industry, I think we need to tackle and maybe unlearn?
Yeah. So I had a bit of a moment during the year, but during 2023. So for context for your wonderful listeners, I spend half my time outside Atlassian with companies of all shapes and sizes going through change, transformation, whatever they call it, normally large enterprises, and trying to help them navigate the treacherous waters of, you know, we're a 200-year-old bank or a 900-year-old telco or whatever they are, and helping them through that. And normally it's the same recipe that you've seen a million times. Like, we got on a plane, we did a study tour of Shopify and Facebook, and I'm like, that's good. You're not a music streaming service and you don't build social media. So why did you do? I mean, did you just fancy a trip to San Francisco? Like, what are you doing? And so this whole nostalgic adage that I can nip over to Spotify and suddenly become a cool company and just call everyone a tribe, I'm done with it. So as I've seen people waste good money on that and not get anywhere, no offense to Spotify, but it's like people just trying to copy and mimic without understanding the nuances. I've been trying to understand, like, what's the reality? So post-pandemic, there was the surge in work futurists. And everyone's now talking about the future of work. And now if you just shout AI or 5G, you're a credible futurist, right? And so I'm seeing all that and I'm like, actually, it's smoke and mirrors. It's a little bit of snake oil. And it's this weird theater and hand wavy, but like you scratch the surface, there's nothing behind it. I had an opportunity last year. A good friend of mine curates South by Southwest Sydney. The first time it's ever run outside of Austin. She rang me up about 7 or 8 days before the event. She's like, something's going on, blah, blah, blah. I need like an opening keynote on the Monday morning. What have you got? And by the way, I prefer you not to use any existing content. I was like, okay, right. So I went back to my notebook and I'm like you, Barry, I write stuff down. Like, I don't always use it, but I write stuff down. So I went through 8 years of working with different customers, different industries, locations, government, you know, private, public, all this stuff. And I'm looking, I'm like, there's got to be some threads in there. And I just had this moment where I'm like, everyone's so distracted by what might be in 2030. Who's looking at 2024? Who's looking for the fertile ground today to plant the seed, to nurture the seed, so we've got something to chop down in 2030? And I realized that it's no one. Everyone's just sort of waving their hands and flapping around on digital whiteboards. So I decided to write what I've called the Modern Work Manifesto, which is like this It's like me yelling from the top of a mountain. Can we stop getting distracted by 2030 and just do a good job today? But to do that, we have to face into the reality of where we're at. And part of the inspiration behind this, and this isn't me blowing smoke up your arse, you've already bought me as many drinks as you're ever going to buy me in a lifetime. I'm not going to get another drink out of you. Is unlearning is a concept in there where I'm like, if you don't face into the reality of where you're at today, you're not going to pay homage to the past. So you're not going to bring the good stuff over, but nor are you going to delete the bad stuff. You're just going to repeat the average things constantly. And that tends to this like midpoint of uselessness. So I'm like, let's not do that. So let's face the reality, honest reality of where we're at today. What are the things we need to kind of unlearn and maybe reduce or get rid of? And what are the things we need to elevate? So my favorite right now in the Modern Work Manifesto is flow over silos. Silos are good. Ask any farmer, right? Farmers love silos. Silos aren't bad, but the fact that the org chart determines how we work is absolutely stupid in 2024. If you build a strategy and cascade it down by departments, you've cascaded something fast and in a useless fashion. Because we all know work happens that way. It happens laterally across the organization. So I'm trying to work with companies to go, how do you get flow across the organization, which is my team understanding who's upstream and who's downstream and having a good social contract with them of how we work together. That adds value. Everything else is theater and noise. So I've got this like, I don't know if it's the addition of, I've got 17-month-old twins at home and I've just got this impatience. Maybe it's the middle-aged man thing. And I'm like, can we just stop with the dance and the pretend and just do something that might be valuable? I don't know. Like if one more person has strategy in the title, I'll pull out the last remaining hair on the head. I'm like, it's not that you're either strategic or tactical. We just need someone to actually do some work because that's what the customer's waiting for. So my thing for this year is with certainly with the leaders I'm working with, C-suite, VPs, whatever, even now for people that aren't called leader, but are leading something, I'm like, find the fertile ground, plant the seed, nurture the seed. And that is a time horizon 2 or 3 activity that you do today for future benefit. Otherwise, we'll inherit a future we don't want. And none of us want that. But we're just sort of, for some reason, we think we're passengers. I'm done with being a passenger.
At least you'll have some funny stories to tell along the way, Dom. That's amazing. You are. But like, you're right on with these ideas of thinking end to end rather than silos, right? I think because our work is getting so much more complicated, I can't think of any task that is on my list in front of me today that I can get done totally on my own. It's absolute, everything involves input from somebody or maybe a sense check, or I'm reliant on an input so I can create an output, you know, or I've experienced even myself quite recently, like I was trying to write an update for a thing that we were working on. I tried to do it all on my own and send it out immediately once the email went out. 3 seconds later, one of the people who could have given input to it was like, sorry, but that information's actually incorrect that you just shared there, Barry, with a mailing list of 2,000 people. So I'm like,
yes, you're like,
oh, great.
It was a test. I'm an auditor. I'm Barry the auditor, and I'm doing a test. I'm doing a mystery shopper, and I've proven that I can't operate independently.
Absolutely. You know, and it just sort of, again, brings like these little micro instances to life about how important it is to think about these end-to-end capabilities that you want to try and build as a company, and then who's going to play their part in that when you design things, right? And it's the now. It's great, you know? So how do you help one or two of the companies get to that place? Because it's hard, right? Like a lot of companies, they're geographically distributed. They're, as you say, functionally organized a lot of the time. Where can people start to trial this and start to figure out how to get better at it?
The first that we're doing at the minute, and again, this is, I've not got a best practice guide that I can share with anyone because I'd be lying if I did, right? And I don't want to be that person. But what we're doing right now is experimenting with companies and going, let's come and have a conversation with your senior leaders. As an example, with the Modern Work Manifesto, it's got 8 things in it. I stick it down in front of them and go, which one of these is your superpower and which one's your kryptonite? They all write it down and then we just show it to each other. And you're like, cool. You think the superpower is evolution over transformation. This person over here thinks it's outcomes over outputs. That's cool. What are you seeing that, and it's not right or wrong, what are you seeing that makes you think that way? And then as an aggregate, what do you want to go after as an organization? What is a superpower that we think will make a demonstrable difference? And which kryptonite might be holding us back? If we don't deal with that first, if we don't do the game of subtraction and remove something that is slowing us down, right, or even stopping us from being more effective, if we don't remove that first, we'll never get to invest in the superpower, right? So it's normally this, what, you know, conversation, and we've done this before, is around balance, right? If you're at capacity, let's not sprinkle anything in. Let's remove something, get to 75%, then add something in, which organizations hate doing. So you've been in these conversations, I, where they're like, these are our priorities for the year. I'm like, oh, 19, that's exciting. So no priorities then. Like, you've not got 19 important things to do. You've really got three, but the other 16 are distracting from the three that are really important. So the great news is that these companies aren't engaging me through a Deloitte, McKinsey type engagement. So they literally get me to do it because I can be brutally honest. I'm not trying to win the next contract off them to sell some agile transformation. So I will be honest. And it hurts. And they're like, we'll never invite you back. And then normally 3 months later, they're like, can you come back and drop some more truth bombs for us? Because we do want to change, right? And so there's a few organizations I'm working with now. And you're just seeing it sort of tweak. So there's one organization I've been working with. They were about to kick off an agile transformation. Doesn't matter that agile was invented 23 years ago, but they're kicking off an agile transformation. And I said to them, do you mind me asking why you've called it that? And they were like, because that's the thing we've bought from the big consulting firm. I'm like, was that the original goal? Like, why are you doing it? And they're like, oh, we want better ways of working because we want more engagement with our teams. Our teams don't like how we work. They find it quite old school. And we want faster time to market on our ideas. I'm like, cool. They're two really good things. I just don't know why you're calling it agile transformation, right? And there was this like pause and they're like, huh. I'm like, because I don't know that that's your goal. Like, you're not going to open the agile room with a ribbon and go, we're now agile. So what's the point? But it started a secondary conversation around, well, what are our goals and what is the current reality? And therefore, where would we start with change? And that became a very action-oriented change program that I'm like, oh, I'll help you with that. But that boring agile transformation, go and give 40 million to someone to give you some PowerPoint slides. Like, that's not my game, right? I don't want to do that, Dan. So the practical, pragmatic, hands-on, like, how do we drive sustainable change? How do we help leaders and teams and organizations thrive? That's the stuff I'm playing with. And just helping people face into that reality of where they're at is the first step. If you don't do that, I probably can't help you. Like, if you don't want to do that, there's someone else will happily charge you sums of money for doing that. But I want to have the honest, forthright conversation around the lived reality. And then what's the next best step? What's the next thing we're going
to
do?
It's great to know that you're out there doing that work now, right? And it sort of ties back, as you say, to your own personal experience of, at an individual level, people being willing to give you candid feedback about what's actually going to help you get better. And as you say, it's hard to get to truth sometimes. Different companies have different incentives. Like you say, big consultancies are, they've got to sell the next deal. They've got to keep the cash rolling in, right? Like, it's hard to find people who will tell you the hard, honest truth sometimes. And it's just great to know that you're out there doing it.
It's also like, as you know, these companies that carry heritage, you know, I asked a group of leaders the question the other week. They were telling me about all the history and heritage of the organization. And it's wonderful. There's so much rich tapestry in there they could bring forward, but it just got a little bit overbearing. So I'll let them finish. And I was like, who here has the desire to be the tour guide at the museum? Who has that desire to do well? This is where we used to have staff. Oh, how they used to enjoy themselves. This is where the ping pong table was. This is where we used to have board meetings. Because the way you're going is you'll run the museum. You don't want to run the museum. You actually want to work at a thriving company. So at some point, let go of the past, right? Not because it's embarrassing, but it worked in that environment, but you're not in that environment anymore. So pay homage to it, but find a way of working that's relevant for the current environment. That's your job as a leader, not to be the tour guide for the museum that no one wants to go and see.
So looking forward, Dom, what are you most excited about? You know, when you look ahead about what's the potential and opportunities for like great places to work?
There's a possible investment, like I hate the cheesy phrase, but like if you look at how much everyone's investing in AI, I hope there's a commensurate investment in human intelligence and that we actually realize that even with AI, machine learning, large language models and all that jazz, like that we still need humans and our curiosity and consciousness and our empathy and all the things that are uniquely human, that we need that, but we need to invest in humans as humans. If I reflect back, most organizations I've worked with in the last probably 20 years have treated humans like machines and have had them competing with the machines. And that's a mindset shift we need to do sooner rather than later, right? That's not going to end pleasurably if we don't do that shift. I think if we do that, we can actually find a way of finding better ways of working, more balance in work. I've certainly found more balance in the last few years since the kids came along. That was a forcing function to find more balance and absolutely still be successful, right? It wasn't all. There was a stage where I thought it was all, like, do I be a good worker or a good friend or a good socializer or a good partner or a good dad? And thankfully, with some communication and expectation setting, I think I'm doing all right at all of them. And I didn't think that was possible. So I want to continue that, but that's going to require me to invest in my human intelligence to be a better dad and a better partner and a better worker. It's not going to happen by accident, right? So I think we need to become a little bit more purposeful. And I hate using that word because it gets me all icky, because people are like, oh, purpose, big P, little P. I'm like, just like, do it on purpose. Have a reason for doing what you're doing rather than just going blindly through the motions. And then for me, I think whether it be that the whole kind of where we work discussion, which hopefully goes away at some point and balances out, I think we have a chance that we've not tapped into yet. And you talked about this before, to build community. I was thinking the other day, like, I play for an over 45s football team, right? We're bang average. We won a medal last year just for surviving, for at least number of ACL injuries, probably.
Yeah, but, I was going to say minimal injuries. Like, in
most players who could walk at the end of the season. But we do play football and we play okay. We're not going to get any major awards. But when the game gets rained off or the odd weekend, we'll meet up for a few beers and we'll chat. And it's like a men's shed where you go with your woodwork to get something fixed. Like, we just chat about stuff and there's no ego there. There's no, I'm the CEO of this and I'm the boss of that. It's a group of like really average, middle-aged, slightly overweight lads having a couple of beers and a chat and talk about life and feeling better by just sharing stuff. And I never really would use the community word to describe that before, but there's something now, because I'm spending less time physically in the office, that community is elevated for me because they have a different role now. They're not just a distraction. They're part of like my psychological safety in life, right? My sense of belonging, my identity is going for a Guinness with the lads, right? And so I think if we can redistribute our time and energy and spend a little bit more on community and self and family and other stuff, I think we can be happier. I think we can actually thrive as a society. It's not going to be the old way. I think people might take on your book and learning and think it just applies to work and not realize it actually applies to life. And that's the bit that people miss. It's like any like self-help development thing I do with a leader, I'm like, you can do this on yourself with your husband or wife, let alone with your colleagues.
Right on. You know, it's great to hear you share all this because for me, again, it's a huge part of the system that keeps me taking over. I need these groups, whether they are their communities, people that I play soccer, or rugby with. There's people that I join that build startups. There are places also where I can go and think differently and be myself and learn from other great folks and help one another. Again, I definitely became very aware of that, certainly in the middle of last year, because I can do 14 calls a day, no worries, but I'm in my office at home on my own, ultimately, you know, and there's a huge thing about, again, one of the reasons why I've certainly focusing much more this year on the proximity aspect of just being around people to help me get better. So yeah, right on.
There's a message in there, Barry, because you've had that before, right? And you're in a different situation now, but it's like, that is an action I believe is within virtually every one of our control, right? It's not unachievable, right? It's very doable. You've just got to get on and do it and crack on. And then when you do, and you find those different communities and groups, honestly, if you find out the thing that fills your cup, don't be apologizing for doing a little bit more of it. If it fills your cup, do a little bit more of it. Stop apologizing. And I think you know that now, and I've learned that, right? And therefore, I think that builds on this level of balance. But I'd say to anyone who doesn't, just go and work out the things that fill your cup and then just do an hour more of it a week and see what happens.
It's always a pleasure to hang out. Loads of fun little anecdotes and stories I'm sure the listeners are going to enjoy for many times over. Thanks for coming to share on the show. And right. I'm definitely Anytime. Sure we're going to have you back again in the future.
Yeah, next time's over a Negroni after what you did to me last time.
I'll leave it at that.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that show, but I'm even more delighted to share the exciting news. I've recently co-founded a new venture studio named Nobody Studios. Now, Venture Studio is a vehicle for the rapid creation of new companies, from ideation to acceleration and growth. And our purpose at Nobody Studios will be to de-risk pre-seed stage business ideas. We'll do this by minimizing the time, speed, and capital involved in validating truly repeatable and scalable business models before any significant venture investment. We've an audacious goal to start 100 compelling companies over the next 5 years, and who knows how many beyond that. So if you're interested in radically changing the way work is done, how products are created, companies built and funded, even democratizing the wealth creation and how returns are distributed, this could be the business for you. We're looking for talent, capital, and influence. If you wish to contribute any or all of these, just get in touch. You can follow us on nobodystudios.com, on our LinkedIn page, all the social media accounts, or simply my newsletters and what I'm sharing. We'll be launching a truly innovative crowdfunding campaign, and I'd be honored if you'd be willing to join us on this journey and become a nobody yourself.